We had almost finished with interfaces on Tuesday. There was one thing left to talk about, and I'd like to go back and talk about that. Not because it's particularly important, but just because it gives you some idea what you're dealing with when you're dealing with cloning. And that is the clone contract. If you remember, we talked about, what did we talk about? O equals. Object.equals has a contract. If you override the object implementation of equals, your implementation had to satisfy those five clauses in the contract. What were those five clauses, just for the hell of it? Okay.
Transitive.
Right. Right, so those are the three for equality. Those are the mathematically three. And then the other two were sort of Java related. Let's see, is that a... The... No, that's a separate issue. The first one is nothing is equal to null. That was the fourth one. And then the last one was the tricky one. Sorry? Right. If you get a, if you say x dot equals y and you change neither x nor y and you call it again, you should get the same answer. We have a similar contract for clone, except, as we'll explain, and the reason I'm talking about this is not really a contract. What would you expect to get from clone? The clone of x is not equal to x. The whole point behind calling clone is to get a copy. So with respect to the identity relationship, and now we're talking about equals as an identity relationship as opposed to a similarity relationship, you would expect that x.clone, whatever you get back from x.clone, should not be x itself. On the other hand, you would expect that the class of the instance returned by clone is equal to the class of the instance on which you are calling clone, because, again, the point here is to make a copy. So x.clone.getClass is, in fact, identical to x.getClass. Finally, you would expect x.clone.equals x to be true. In other words, the thing that you return should be whatever your definition of equality is for that class should be equal to that. The interesting thing, though, is if you look at the, and these are the things that you take, I took these from the Java API page in Object under the clone method. It says, in fact, I think it says it two or three times. These are not absolute requirements. You don't have to actually do this. So in that sense, it's not really a contract at all, because you don't have to do it if you don't want to. In some cases, there are good reasons. For example, if you're talking about immutable instances, there's really no reason to clone those, because you really can't tell the difference anyway. So if you do have immutable instances, for example, you can violate this. You can essentially say, oh, I'm immutable, so I'll just return myself. You can also, if you want, make a copy, but certainly it would be acceptable to violate the contract and return not equals. For some reason, this is also, I have seen it written that violating the get class identity is also useful on occasion, although they never actually explain why that's the case, so I really can't. I've seen people say that you really don't have to obey this one, but I don't know why you would not want to do that. This one, I never heard anybody say that you shouldn't do it. So I just wanted to mention that as an example. Cloning, I don't mention it so much because I anticipate that you're going to go out and do clone, but more because you are going to look at code that calls clone, and it's good to have some idea of what's going on there when they're trying to do that. There are, and I believe Horstman and Cornell mentioned this, there are other ways to get copies, serialization being one of them. Not a particularly good way, but certainly one way to do it. So that's, and then that's the summary. I just wanted to finish that out. Today we'll be talking about interclasses, which are another feature of Java that makes Java programming sort of fun. This is as close as you can get, more or less, to the notion of function pointers or first-order functions in Java without having to go to proxies and reflection and all that other stuff. So from that point of view, the fact that we can somehow get an approximation of first-order functions in Java means that this represents a point at which you can have fun writing Java programs. Although, of course, this is Java, so it's like whatever that movie was where the kid wanted to go ride on his bicycle, so his mother put him in a safety vest and a helmet, and so by the time the kid was on the bicycle, it was this huge mound of protective clothing wheeling down the street. Similarly, inner classes are going to be a pain. When we get to the end, I'll have a little bit more to say about inner classes. The other reason I'm talking about this is because this is going to be an important concept when we get to the swing and, to a lesser extent, the AWT user interface code, graphical user interface code, because that makes heavy use of inner classes and, what was the other one? Inner classes and, it's escaped me for the moment, but similarly with respect to inner classes. We'll talk about another motivation for considering inner classes is information hiding and namespace control. This, in this case, it's similar to what you have in C++, although it's a lot simpler. We're going to introduce a new entity. I introduced three entities up to this point. We're now going to introduce the fourth and, I believe, final entity in our list. We're also going to introduce a new scope. In fact, depending on how you want to count, we're going to introduce one or two or three new scopes. And we'll talk about on-the-fly class creation, which is the part that's quasi-fun. Let's go back and think about how we would implement an NRE tree. NRE trees have up to n children, if you remember from wherever you learned that. If you're going to implement an NRE tree, depending upon how you want to implement it, there's lots of different ways, but the obvious way you would implement it, you're going to need some representation of a node in an NRE tree. So the implementation would consist of the tree as well as the definition of this node that you're going to use. How can we implement that node? What are some of the ways that we might think about doing it? Well, you can store children, and the issue here, of course, I mean, the reason this is an interesting question is you're allowed to specify n. So I can create a 2-array tree or a 10-array tree. And I have to be able to provide for that variable number of children. If I'm just doing a binary tree, then the problem's solved, not a real big deal. But if I have the ability to specify the maximum number of children, then it becomes a little bit more tricky. So we can store the children in arrays and linked lists, hash tables, you know, all the usual things we talked about. The choice depends a lot on n, depends on what kind of operations you expect to get, all the usual things. But we're not so much interested in that as forcing a particular decision based on the choice that you made. There are a couple of things, regardless of how you decide to implement the tree, there are a couple of properties that your implementation should have. The first one is the way that you actually implement it, in other words, the details of how you represent children, should be hidden. They are not really relevant outside the definition of the NRE tree, as long as you satisfy the implicit or perhaps explicit constraints on what you would anticipate to be the contract for an NRE tree. That has a couple of the reasons why you want to hide the implementation. There are a couple of justifications for that. First one, it preserves the ability to change the node implementation. Suppose you say that, oh, you know, I don't want to have to deal with dynamic storage. So let me just use arrays. I'll use a bunch of arrays, and we'll let it go with that. Now, if it turns out that in addition to having wildly varying tree sizes, those sizes are also big, then arrays are probably not going to be efficient because you're going to be adjusting the size of the arrays and you're going to be doing a lot of copying. At that point, you realize you made a bad mistake and you have to go back and change your internal representation to make it more appropriate to a large and widely varying number of elements in your tree. If the implementation details are visible outside your tree class, you're stuck because you don't know if any of your clients have relied on those visible implementation details. They may have latched on to the fact that the children are stored in arrays, for example, and you can't change that because now you're going to break your client's code. On the other hand, if your clients are ignorant of the implementation details, you can change away. Another reason is you don't want to pollute the namespace with, for example, what you call your tree node. Tree node's a pretty obvious name. You might expect that your clients would have it in addition to the representation of the implementation of your NRE tree. If that's the case, then you could have a name clash there. You don't want to do that. The design issue, or the, well, not so much design, but implementation issue here is how can the node class be hidden from everything, all the clients in particular, but the NRA tree implementation. Notice that package level scope doesn't give you any help, because everything in that package has the ability to see that, oh, this NRA tree uses these tree nodes. So that doesn't help you. Every other class in the that's what I just said, has the ability to look at the tree nodes. And of course, going up, going to public, isn't very helpful, since that just broadens the problem. And then going down isn't very helpful either, right? Because protected is just another name for package. And then there's private, but that's not even clear what that would mean. Well, actually, we'll figure out what it means in a couple of minutes. So the solution to this problem of both hiding the representation from the clients in particular, but from other code, and controlling the population of the namespace, the public namespace, if you like, or the more widely available namespace, is this notion of an inner class. You can also think of inner as being nested, a nested class. This helps solve the node hiding problem. An inner class, as the name suggests, is just a class defined inside another class. So this is the fourth entity we've talked about. There are classes, or outer classes, if you will, methods, instance variables, and now we've introduced inner classes. Classes not contained in other classes are known as top-level classes. The interesting thing about inner classes, as opposed to the outer or top-level classes, is they can have the full set of access permissions: public, package, default, protected, or private. Now we know the answer. The node class can be a private inner class to the tree class. Private, again, means that only the containing class has access to that entity, in this case being the inner class, which is exactly what we want. Nothing outside can get to it, and the namespace is hidden inside the containing class. How many people have written nested classes in C++? I would imagine everybody does, right? Because they have you do, linked list or something like that? So everybody has experience doing this. Okay. Here's an example. We have the NRA tree class. It has a bunch of stuff, and inside we have the implementation of the nodes of the tree. Declare it to be a private class, NRA tree node. You can call it whatever you want because you can change it, and you don't have to worry about conflicts with client code. NRA tree can access NRA tree node, but no other class, including NRA tree ancestors, because again, this is the private behavior, can. So if I, for some reason, I decide to allow inheritance from the NRA tree, the children of NRA tree don't have access to the NRA tree node, which suggests that probably it would be a good idea to declare this to be a final class so that it can't be extended. But that's up to you. That's one justification for having a inner class. It allows you to hide implementation details better than using packages. This is the reason I'm really disappointed in packages. You should be able to make that kind of hiding behavior without relying on nested classes, because it tends to bloat your code. Right? What it means is all the implementation details you want to hide have to be stuffed in the class that you want to hide them in. It would have been much better if you could have a package which essentially allows you to make one thing public and then everything else is inaccessible outside the package. That would have been nice, but you can't do that. And again, that's a heritage of the idea that, well, you know, we're going to be writing for devices. Devices have half a megabyte of storage. You know, you can't write big things. We don't have to worry about that. Well, they were wrong. On the other hand, sometimes you have the opposite problem. You would like to have two classes that should be tied together and made available as a unit. So you have some auxiliary data type that you would like to have work in concert with your main data type, and you would like to have those things be united together so that they can be dealt with as a team. Non-private inner classes can help solve this problem. I have an example on the next slide. This is a less compelling use of inner classes, but it's occasionally useful. This is similar to having, for example, in C++, you would put enumerated types in your class so that you could make various parameters, values, be more mnemonic than just integers. Here's an example. I have an admissions queue which accepts entities as long as they have a ticket. So this ticket data type would be the auxiliary data type. I suppose if I was clever, I would have had an NQ operation here that actually showed you with the ticket parameter. Or alternatively, the NQ operation could return a ticket which represents that entity on the queue. In either case, there's a tie between the queue itself and these tickets. And what we'd like to do is we'd like to have those two data types closely related. Now, of course, we can put the ticket in the same package as the admission queue. And that might work, but the problem is you may have other classes in the same package as admission queue, and then it becomes less clear the importance of just the admission queue and the ticket. If those were the only two classes in your package, that would make it clear those are tied together. But if you have other classes in your package, then it becomes less clear. Well, we can embed the auxiliary class in the main class, so we can embed tickets in admission queue, and we could make ticket be public. Now it's accessible, it has the same access rules as admission class does, and it's clear that this is related to admissions queue, because as we talk about right here, you would access ticket by admission queue.ticket. This is the opposite approach to, or opposite justification for allowing inner classes, the fact that you can present auxiliary types, classes, or perhaps other things too, as being directly tied to the main class, as opposed to hiding them like we were doing for the NRE trees. Those are nice. It makes things nice, particularly since Java doesn't give you any particular other useful way to do this. Now we're talking about a more important and more general reason. These reasons I gave you previously were kind of, you would certainly run across them, right? You implement various classes. Those classes may have auxiliary data types which either should be hidden completely from clients or tied somehow to the main class. But even if you don't write any classes on your own, create new data types, you still have to know how to deal with inner classes because of this, the reason we're going to talk about now, which is the notion of an iterator. One of the things you want to provide in your tree class is a mechanism for going from element to element in the tree traversal. In the case of NRE trees, it makes most sense to have pre- and post-order traversals. You could have NRE, you could have in-order traversals, too, if you define what in means for an NRE tree, which you can certainly do. But we can rely on our knowledge of what pre- and post means to fairly obviously define them for NRE trees. To make that available, we could certainly have a method that says post-order traversal and accepts some parameters and goes galumphing around the tree. On the other hand, Java provides an interface that is the standard, or quasi-standard, I guess we could say, for providing access to collections of data, sequential access to collections of data. And that's the iterator interface. So here's an example of an interface that's defined in Java. It contains three methods. I don't remember exactly whether there are any other methods, but there are certainly these are the three important ones. The hasNext determines whether or not there's another element in the sequence to retrieve. Next actually retrieves that element if it does exist, and remove is an optional method which will remove the element, the next element in the sequence. And this is the way that in general you are supposed to go over or present sequences of data in a collection, such as a tree. Here is an example of how you would use an iterator interface to the NRE tree. I declare an NRE tree, and I don't remember what the parameter means. Maybe that means, it means 10 children. So we put a bunch of stuff in there somehow, and then we call an iterator. Notice that we're calling the iterator on the tree, so we're getting an iterator for that tree, that particular instance of the tree. We're getting a pre-order iterator. And then we just go through the loop. While I has elements in it, while the sequence in the tree has elements, we get the next element. Notice here I'm treating them as objects. And then we process that element however we'd like, and just keep doing this until we run out of elements, in which case hasNext will return false, and then we're done. So this is a pretty nice way to deal with tree iteration and going through a sequence of elements in general. How do we implement that? How do you provide that? We need to have a tree iterator class, because the iterator itself is an interface. It doesn't have any code associated with it. Now we have to figure out, where do we put the tree iterator class? And now we have two things to decide. Do we want to hide it, or do we want to tie it? And in this case, the answer is probably you want to do both, right? Because you certainly need to tie them, because the tree iterator is not going to be useful for any other data type. So standing, it doesn't stand on its own, which means that you probably want to tie them together. On the other hand, how the tree iterator is implemented is irrelevant, just as long as it gives me a pre-order traversal or a post-order traversal. So in that case, we want to satisfy both those criteria. We want to hide some things and present other things, or tie them together. Fortunately, we can do that because we're implementing an interface. If you understand that you're going to get back an interface, you know how to deal with it, which means that you don't need, in fact, you need hardly any detail. The only thing you need to know is the name of, actually, you probably don't even need to know that, because you can declare it to be an iterator. Right? So you don't even need to know what the name of the tree iterator is, because you can just treat it using polymorphism, as we talked about last week from today, an iterator. Because it's interesting only to the NRE tree, we want to make tree iterator be an inner class. Well, of course, that's where I was leading up to. But those are the steps that you would take to make that decision. Doesn't really stand on its own as a class, and the details of the actual implementation aren't really interesting. As long as they satisfy the iterator contract, we're satisfied. All right, let's go on and do the implementation. How is tree iterator implemented? How would you go ahead and implement it?
They would have to have space for a node, your current node, whatever you're sitting on.
The what now?
The iterator.
Right. So what does the iterator do? Right, it's glumping through the tree in post-order or pre-order. So how do we do that? How do we glump through the tree?
Or do you get next node? So I guess it hinges on the next node method.
Right, you'd start at the root, and then what you'd have to do is you'd have to dive down to the first element. And that would be the first thing you return, and then you retreat back up to the parent and go down to the think about a binary tree. You go down to the left, go up to the parent, and go to the right. Right? And then you'd go back, and since you've covered both the left and the right, you retreat again. So you'd need a pointer to a node, and you'd also need some sort of state to indicate whether you went left or right. And if you went left, you go down right. If you went down right, then you retreat back to the parent. It's a little tricky, but it's actually an interesting exercise, because I've actually started doing this. Rather than implementing pre and post traversals, or for that matter, in-order traversals for binary trees, I actually now make tree traversals available as iterators. And it turns out to be a lot nicer. I was kind of surprised, because I like recursion. Recursion is fun. But treating the traversal as an iterator, it turns out to be actually kind of pleasant. So the iterator needs access to the NRE tree innards. That's the important point. You can't implement a tree from the outside. You need to be able to look at the nodes and say, oh, I went down this one on the previous iteration, so now I get to go down the next child. I also need to have access to the root, because I need to know where to start. On the other hand, NRE tree innards should be private. They shouldn't be made available outside the class of the tree itself. C handles this, C++ handles this with friends. You can make the iterator class be a friend of the tree class. Mercifully, Java does not do that. That leaves the question, where is tree iterator relative to NRE tree? Again, the obvious tendentious argument I've been presenting up to this point, we make it a class of NRE tree. So we have a private class, NRE tree iterator, which implements iterator. this is the constructor for the NRE tree iterator, and then I have to fulfill the obligation of the interface. I need next, has next, next, and I guess in this case we're not going to do remove, so we'd have to implement that, but it would do something like blow up if you called it. And the prefix iterator that I called in my example code here would essentially create an NRE tree iterator and then return it. Notice that I'm using the parent type or the interface type here to specify a ancestor of the actual type, which is NRE tree iterator. So again, the type does not escape the NRE tree class itself. I can treat whatever comes back as an iterator. Okay, questions about that? What does that look like when you use it? We have an NRE tree, I add some things to it, and I get an iterator. At this point, what do I have? I have the variable t, which points off to an instance of an NRE tree. Part of the instance variables in the NRE tree is a pointer to an NRE tree node, which is an inner class to NRE tree. NRE tree node contains children, contains a couple of things, but it contains children which point off to other NRE tree nodes. I is an iterator from the tree T. It contains access to the root. Notice it doesn't contain the root, it has access to the root because it needs to know where to start. And it also has a pointer to the node that it's currently traversing. It has some other things, too, that you'd have to implement, but those are the important ones. This all comes from NRE tree. The only thing the client knows about is NRE tree. These other classes, NRE tree node, NRE tree iterator, are hidden. I can change them, I can do whatever I want to them, and it has no effect on the client, including the NRE tree iterator, because again, we're presenting it as an iterator. Notice how painful it would be if I didn't want to do this. If I wanted to say, oh no, I want to make it, I want to make this be accessible from outside the NRE tree class. It becomes a lot more complicated now because this would no longer be private. And now you have to be careful about the things that you reveal when you make this. Presumably you'd have to match the access permissions on the tree class itself, so this would also have to be public. So you have to be careful about the things that you reveal. And effectively what you would do is you would add another level of indirection. So essentially the only thing that the NRE tree iterator class would do would be declare another iterator, which was private to NRE tree iterator, which implemented everything else. There's no particular advantage to doing that. On the other hand, it may be useful for certain contexts. Questions about this? This is I won't say it's really important, but you really should understand what's going on here in terms of this picture, in terms of the instances that you're creating and the relationship among those instances, because all these things are related by the NRE tree class itself, is the point. And it gets much more complicated than this, of course. It can get, let's put it that way. All right, let's see. Those are my rationalizations for the concept of interclass. And as I said, we'll have some other ones when we get to Swing and AWT. Are there any questions on what we've talked about so far? All right, so let's go on. And I've introduced a new feature. I've introduced our fourth entity, interclass. Now we have to figure out how it interacts with everything else. And here's where it starts to get ugly. The first question you want to ask yourself is, okay, how many scopes have we got now? I've introduced a new entity, and it seems fairly clear that that entity is going to drag with it some issues associated with scope, right? Because the entity itself is a scope. So now we've got to figure out what the relationship is between that entity scope and then everything else that we have laying around. So an inner class instance has access to the outer class instance that created it, which again is similar to C++. You're allowed to, from the inner class, go out and touch all the things in the embedding class, or the outer class, or the top-level class, although that's actually not quite correct in this case. The reference, however, to those entities in the outer class is a little bit more complicated. The outer class reference is named outer class.this in the inner class. And so it's actually a two-part name. There's the this part, which you might expect, but you have to indicate what this you're talking about, whether you're talking about the inner class instance or the enclosing class instance. And you do that by adding the name of the enclosing class. If there is no ambiguity, in other words, if you're only referring to a name that's unique among everything in the enclosing class, including the inner class, then you can drop outer class.this because the reference to that unique name is clear. On the other hand, if the inner class has some, for example, variable named moo, and the outer class also has a variable named moo, then the reference to moo is ambiguous, and you have to clarify by either saying this.moo or outer class.this.moo. There's a picture coming up that will explain that. This reference gives the inner class instance access to the outer class instance features. This is independent of the access permissions. The inner class has access to everything in the outer class, even private. Here's an example. I have an outer class which has a string called moo, which should be private. And I have a method called say, which prints out whatever this class says, system.out.println.what. And I have an inner class which has a method which says call say talk. Now the question is, what say are we talking about? What say are we referring to in this statement? Well, there's actually only one definition of say, and that's here. So this is an unambiguous reference. This is also an unambiguous reference because we only have one entity called talk. On the other hand, I could make it explicit and have the identical call, but with a different syntax, outer class.this.say, outer class.this.talk. Generally speaking, this full qualification on the name or the entity that you're referencing is more descriptive and is the one I recommend. Unless you have something that's as short as this example is, it's better to make it clear. Because as you might expect, and as I was whining about earlier, these inner classes tend to bulk up your enclosing class, your embedding class. You now are running across several pages of output, and when you refer to some entity just by talk, it is now no longer clear what you're talking about, whether you are referring to something in the inner class or in one of the enclosing classes. And actually, it gets worse, as we'll see. So my recommendation is when you use inner classes, use the fully qualified reference to the entities, even when you can get away with using just the entity names themselves. Nested class scope. There are now three nested class scopes. There's the inner class method scope, which is this scope here from the start of Go to the end of Go. There is the inner class scope itself, which is from inner class open to inner class close. And then there's the outer class or enclosing class scope. And I should probably make this clear. This is the directly enclosing outer class. You can repeatedly nest inner classes. So this inner class could have another inner class. Now we have two enclosing classes. We have this one, and then we have the original outer class. This class, the inner class, is the directly enclosing one. And then this is the second level or whatever. The reason that's important is each inner class can only access its immediately enclosing outer class. So if you wanted to access something further up the hierarchy, you would have to add more names to your qualification. Again, assuming it wasn't unique. Here's an example of that. I have a class T, which has an inner class U, which has an inner class V. So now I have two nested classes. I have I, U, and V. We go to the method scope in the innermost class. We have an I here, which is in the method scope. So this is method scope. Here's another I, but in this case I'm saying this.i, which refers to the class scope, this instance variable. Then we have outer class scope, u.this.i, which refers to the enclosing class scope. Needless to say, this is terrible programming. You shouldn't do this, but this illustrates the three scopes that you have available to you. All right, questions about that? The idea of outer class access and information hiding are separate but related features. We have the same problem over again, right? Just because the class is nested within another class does not mean that you want to make everything in the inner class accessible. You still should adhere to the properties of information hiding. That doesn't work in the opposite direction. A nested inner class has access to everything in the outer class, which, you know, may be unacceptable. Maybe you don't want to do that, but unfortunately you don't have much choice. What we'd like to be able to say is this is an inner class, and essentially this is, in some sense, independent of the outer class. Right? I am willing to forego all access to my outer class because I don't care what class I'm in. What I do is independent of being nested in a particular class. That's the idea that inner classes may be hidden and may not need access to the embedding or the outer class. And in that being the case, you should not have to have it preserve encapsulation. Declaring an inner class static eliminates the outer class reference. If that's the case, if you have an inner class that can execute in essentially context-independent ways, then if you declare it a static inner class, it loses its access to the outer class. Do I have an example of that? Yes. And in particular, NRE tree nodes don't really care about the tree that uses them. The only thing they care about is the, what do they care about? Well, if we use nodes, they don't care about anything, actually. I guess they don't even have to worry about root because they get put into root by something else. So that means that they shouldn't have access to the outer class, the NRE tree class features. Now, an NRE tree node should be a static inner class. So rather than declare it to be a private class NRE tree node, we declare it to be a private static class NRE tree nodes, and that essentially removes the ability to use the outer class dot this dot whatever. This now becomes a context-independent inner class. In theory, anyway, I could rip this out of NRE tree node and stick it in some other class because this doesn't access any of the features of the enclosing class, so it doesn't really care. Whether that works or not is a separate issue. But we can do it. Notice that we have now introduced another definition of static. Static we use to indicate the... So what did we use? So static indicates what? What are some of the uses of static we've gotten so far?
Whatever the static method is universal, it could be called without instantiating a class.
Right, so we use static as a marker for a class-level feature as opposed to a class-instance-level feature. There is actually one we didn't talk about, but Horstman talks about it too. I'll tell you that one. You can have a static initialization block in your code, so that's the second use. What's the third use? Is there a third use?
Or variables or whatever.
I'm wondering if I folded that into Matt's suggestion. So you can have a static variable, right, which means it's a class variable. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah.
So you can have a static variable or you can have a static method. I essentially assume those are the same semantics. You're declaring a class-level entity as opposed to a class-instance-level entity. I'm pretty sure there's one more. What is it? There's final class, which means that you can't extend it. All right, maybe there isn't. Maybe I'm confused. Maybe I'll remember it. But all right, so this will be the third use. We could declare a static inner class, which essentially says this is a context-independent class. Any questions about that? About the idea of scope. So we've introduced now a third and possibly, no, we've introduced a fourth and possibly a fifth scope if you want to throw in the interclass method scopes. All right, we shall go on. We use the new operator to create class instances. Okay, no surprise. Why can't an interface be instantiated in the same way? Why can't I call new comparable to get a reference to a comparable instance?
Interfaces are abstract.
Right, so what does that mean?
It can't be instantiated.
Why not? That's what I said. Yeah. You have to tell me why. You have to tell me why they can't be instantiated. That's true. Nothing is defined. There are no methods associated with the no method definitions associated with the interface. So we can't implement an interface, or we can't instantiate an interface because nothing in it is defined. Has no methods to call through the instance. With that in mind, what would we have to provide in order to be able to instantiate the interface? Remember, I told you, I don't know when it was, maybe it was on Tuesday that, oh no, it was last week. It was a week from today that I said you can't instantiate abstract classes because they could potentially have undefined methods. And the question is, if you instantiate it and then call that method, what happens? And then I said, well, but it turns out you can define or you can instantiate abstract classes. And I'm going to show you how. And now we're going to talk about that. So what would you have to do in order to be able to instantiate an interface? Exactly. If you want to instantiate an interface, what you'd have to do is define all those methods. And then you can call it, and then you can instantiate it, and then call those methods. Oop, I see it's a little too big. Let's go back. Now, I guess the claim here is I just hit minus. Oh, yeah, there we go. What would be necessary to instantiate an interface or abstract classes more generally, since an interface is just a stylized abstract class? As Patricia said, if an abstract class had all of its methods, we could instantiate it. Given that I have a comparable, what do I need in order to be able to instantiate it? Well, I need a compares to method, so I can do that. I can define a new comparable, and I can use this dreadful, dreadful syntax, which says public int compare to object, and then do something to do the comparison. In this case, I just return minus one. But, of course, you could do other things if you wanted to. Other more sensible things. And then I can just call compare to. Now it's important to pick this apart. This looks, up to this point, looks familiar. This looks just like this, except we don't have a semicolon here. And this is important because I could never really understand the syntax until I came across this little formulation of it. And so up to this point, everything looks the same. The only problem here is that this is an abstract class, so we're going to have some trouble. And as Patricia pointed out, if you want to actually have this work, you're going to have to put extra stuff in there in order to get it to go. And what is that extra stuff? The extra stuff are the definitions of the methods. Well, we can put those at the end. So we need to add extra stuff. We're defining methods. That means you need to have the curly brackets because, in a sense, we are creating a new class. So we put the class brackets in, and now we define the methods given in the interface. In this case, there's only one. Let's see. Everyone got that? When you do that, you have what's known as an anonymous class. You are clearly no longer creating a comparable because that's an interface, and interfaces don't have defined methods. But we haven't given it a name. I can't call it comparable because there's always something there that has the name comparable. What we are defining is what's known as an anonymous class. It's an instance of a complete abstract class. The instance's type is anonymous. Is it anonymous subclass of the abstract class, which means essentially it's a one-off. You don't know what the name is. It has some unique name, and it's based on the type of the abstract class that you are instantiating, but you don't know what that name is. Otherwise, it's just like a subclass of the abstract class, which means that you can pass it around as an instance of the abstract class itself. it is perhaps more accurate to think of them, rather than as anonymous classes, is better perhaps to think of them as anonymous subclasses, because you're specifying an abstract class, perhaps in the form of an interface, and then you're creating a subclass or a child of that interface or abstract class with some anonymous type. And the instantiation syntax, is similar to non-anonymous class instantiation. In other words, you have a constructor call, right, which is what we had here. Right, that looks like this. And then you have the features that were not defined in your abstract class that you need to define in order to be able to have an instantiatable class. The important thing to remember here, this is an expression. So you can not only put it here in a declaration, but you can put it other places too. Right? This is an expression, so you can actually use this all over the place, which turns out to be useful. The value that gets returned is a reference to the anonymous class instance. Notice I can only create one instance of that class. Right? Why is that? What happens if I try and create two instances? Right, I can create comparable C1 that looks like this, and suppose I make a copy of this and create comparable C2. The question is, what's the relationship between C1 and C2? Well, they do have a relationship, but what is that relationship?
They're siblings, but they're not of the same class.
Exactly, they're siblings of the comparable interface, but they have different classes. And why do they have different classes? Right. Each time you create an anonymous class, you create a new subclass. So this would create, for example, comparable $1 as a name. And then if I copied this and created and had a second variable C2, that would create comparable $2, for example, or 1, I guess, if I start from 0. The trailing block has to override all abstract methods. Right? If you have any methods that are abstract, then you can't instantiate it. So you have to, when you define an anonymous class, you have to define all the abstract methods. You can also add new features. You can put new things in there, too. You can define other methods. You can have instance variables. You can have inner classes. You can go to town, which is not recommended, but you can certainly do it. So from that point of view, it's like dealing with an inner class. Here's an example of that. I have an abstract class T, which has a defined method called T, which is actually the constructor. And then it has an abstract method called Moo. I can't instantiate an instance of class T because of the abstract method. On the other hand, I can create a new T as long as I define the abstract class. Notice that I'm calling the constructor here, which means that I need to provide whatever the parameters the constructor expects. In this case, I don't have a default constructor. I have to use the constructor that class T defines, so I pass in an integer and a string. Here's Moo. Right, so I fulfilled my obligation to define the abstract class or the abstract method. Now this class is no longer abstract. Everything's defined. Now I stick some other things in here, like a label and another method. So there's an example of adding other things to an anonymous class. Yes, apparently that's it. Any questions?
Why would you want to do that? Like, let's say you were going to the comparable instance. Would the idea be, let's say you implemented a comparable. Could you go back later in the code, and let's say you wanted to basically overload the compare to just to do something different in that segment of code? Is that basically the way you would use it, or?
Let's see. I could answer that. Let's see if I can give you an example from real life. Oh, bummer, I can't. Maybe I can. this is my implementation of last year's solution. And in the player API directory, I have a bunch of interfaces defined. One of them is card piles, okay, which are the piles of cards that you have. And if we take a look, it essentially defines a bunch of enumerations for the different cards. In this case, there are four foundation cards, and then there's a bunch of other ones. But in addition, it defines some operations, and one of those is a pair iterate static function. And essentially what this pair iterate does is it goes through all the piles and calls a function for each pair. So it creates all possible pairs of piles, which is essentially a Cartesian product, and then calls a function on those two pairs, on those two piles. And of course the idea here is you're simulating moves. It's a very stupid way to simulate moves because it considers all possible pairs and not all of those pairs are legal. So just as a simple example, let's have a really simple game that has four piles, tableau 0, tableau 1, it has a foundation pile, and it has a discard pile. Right, so those are my four piles. What this pair iterate does is it creates the cross product of this set. So I have, for example, tableau 0, tableau 0, tableau 0, tableau 1, tableau 0 foundation, and tableau 0 discard. Right? And then I have tableau 1, tableau 0, and so forth and so on. So this in a sense is a simulation of this is the source pile for the move and this is the destination pile. So in a sense, that creates all possible moves, even though some of these moves may not be legal. For example, you generally speaking can't move from a discard pile, but that depends on the game. So in this case, I would have 16 possible pairs. What do I do with those pairs when I generate them? Well, I have a function that's called pairFun. And what happens is I iterate through those card piles and I call a method on each one of those pairs. And the method I call is cardFun. So let's go take a look at that. PairFun, I'm sorry. All right, so first of all, what does this tell you? What does this name tell you? It's an inner class, right? But it also tells you something else. It's an interface, right? So you can have inner interfaces, too. In fact, if you remember back when I talked about interfaces, I said, you can have variables, which you shouldn't have. You can have methods, and you can have other things. Another thing that you can have is a class. Another thing you can have is an interface. So here's an example of where I have an interface. And what's in that interface? It's a method called f, quite creatively, I think. And then there's the two piles, pile 1, which is you can think of that as being the from pile, and then pile 2 is the to pile. And the description is down here. Perform some operation on a given pair of cards, and at this point you're on your own. The return value controls the way that you can iterate through. If it returns 0, then you continue to iterate on the next pair in the sequence. If it returns 1, you break the inner iteration, which essentially varies the rightmost pair, the rightmost card in the pair, and if it's 2, you just break out completely. All right, so we have a class called CardPiles, and then in that class we have, and this is a public interface because you see it in the documentation. This is the default documentation, which means that you're only looking at public and protected entities. And then within that interface, you have this method. Okay. Now, let's get to your question. How would you use that? Let's see if I have an example of that. Any questions about this? So let's see if I can scratch up an example of how you would use it. Oh, I have a question. Let's take a little poll. How many people are running Windows at home? How many people? Well, okay. If you run more than one, that's fine. Okay. How many people are running Linux? Debian?
Ubuntu?
Okay, so everybody's running Ubuntu? What you? Linux, which kind? Which distribution?
Just the one.
Red Hat?
Yeah.
Okay, so Red Hat. Max? What else you got?
A laptop?
That's fine. Is it what, OS X or?
I forget. I got it from a friend.
Oh, okay. All right, let's see. Where am I here? Oh, I know where you can do it. All right. Oh, you see, now, look how big this is. See, this is 523 lines. Oh, that's just terrible. And the reason it's that big is because I have lots of inner classes. One of the other methods I have in this implementation is, where is it? Oh, no, it would be an eagle's wing. That's implementation. I want player API. One of the methods I have in my implementation of the game is a method called moves possible, and it returns true if there is a move possible in the game. Or it returns false if there are no possible legal moves. How do you implement that? Right, you go through every possible move, and if you find one that's legal, you return true. If you find none of them that are legal, you return false. How do I implement that? How do I iterate through all possible moves? I've already done it. Use a pair fun. So that's what this code is. Here is the possible moves possible. Notice that this is nested inside a method. So this is a class that is nested not in a class. Well, it's nested in the class, but it's also further nested inside a method. Okay, and again, this is method scope. So this class is not available outside this method. But it is the moves parfun. It implements parpiles.parfun, which you remember was just that one method f, which is here. It accepts the from pile and the to pile, and then you do the check here. You do some stuff. But anyway, this does the check. Okay? This turns out to be more complicated than it needed to be. Then I create an instance of moves parfun, and then I call the pair iterate on parfun and return the moves possible. Notice that I needed to return a value from this method. I need to indicate whether or not I ran across, in my iteration, I ran across a legal move. But there's no way to do that from the interface itself. So I need to declare a variable that I can later access, and it's the variable that contains the return value. That's actually a little tricky. You probably don't have any way to... I guess you do. I think the documentation for this is online last year. But here's an example of adding things to an interface when defining it. In this case, this is not anonymous. I could have made it anonymous if I wanted to, but then it would have looked funny because then I would have had to replace this with this huge thing. So I just declared the class here as part of this method. The important point here is that this class, movesParFun, is not available anyplace else outside this method. So that's an example of how you would use it. It also turns out to be a useful way to test your code, of course, because it runs through every possible pair, and you shouldn't core dump if you do that. So that actually turned out to be surprisingly handy. I developed that the way I usually develop things. I think I wrote this first, which essentially did what parfuns did, except it did it in the implementation rather than back in the interface. And then I wrote it again someplace else. And as soon as you write the same piece of code twice, you have to stop and say, all right, what is this saying to me? And what it's saying to me is this idea of iterating over all possible pairs is a useful thing. So I abstracted that out into the parfun interface. The parfun static method, which used the, card pairs static method, which used the parfun interface to pass in the behavior that you want to have for each one of the pairs. And this, see, this is nice. This is the way you should write programs. Unfortunately, you shouldn't write them like this where you have all this garbage. It's a lot quicker in other programming languages, but still you can do it. Let's see. Is there anything else I want to say about this? I guess not. Any questions about what this, how I did this? So that's an example of how you would do it. Let's see. Do I have any other examples? I'm sure I do, but right offhand I can't think of them. Well, let's see. There were a couple of occurrences of pair fun. Let's try this again. Okay. I don't know. But that's an example of how you use it. Was that your question?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Any other questions? Well, let's see. I suppose I can let you go. But I don't think so. So let's look at this semester's problem. I thought this was interesting. In fact, I still haven't come up with an answer to it. So to a certain extent, I can talk through the possibilities. So the game that I'm implementing this semester is called 8 Off. And it has four different kinds of piles. It has tableaus, foundation, free. It only has three different kinds of piles. Tableau, foundation, and free. You have to deal all the cards at the beginning of the game, so all the cards are out. In addition, each move consists of moving one card, the top card, from one pile to another. So that's essentially what a move is. It's none of these, like some games will let you pick up a run of cards as one unit and move it. But this game isn't like that. It's just you're moving a single card from one pile to another. In addition, there are constraints on the ways in which you can add cards to a pile. Let me see if I can remember this now. Foundations are built by increasing rank, uniform suit from the ace. Right, so you're going from ace to king, uniform suit. So there are four foundation piles, one for each suit. Tableau is just decreasing rank. If you lay a top... Oh, you have decreasing rank and top suit match. You don't have to match all the suits in the tableau. You just have to match the top suit. In the case of free piles, you're limited to having one card. There are 8 free piles, there are 8 foundation piles, and then there are 4 tableaus. No, sorry. 8 tableaus, 4 foundations. Each one of these starts off with 6 cards. This is empty. 4 contain one card, and then the other 4 are empty. So that's essentially the game of 8 off, and then you play it from there. And the objective, of course, is to get all the cards into the foundation. All right, everyone got that? Now the question is, how do I implement the piles? If you look, there's a lot of things the same here. The fact that a move from pile to pile consists of a top card going from one pile to another. That's the same for all of these, but they all have constraints on whether or not an incoming top card is acceptable. For example, in the case of a free pile, the free pile has to be empty. If it is, it's an acceptable card. If it's not, it is not acceptable. This is a good example of doing object-oriented programming because we now have tensions. There's a lot of similarity here, right? The way that you move cards, the way the cards are handled. These are all face-up cards, too, I should say, right? There's none of this face-down stuff. And so all the cards are face-up. We do have these constraints over here. And that's the difference. They're all similar, but they're also all different. When you have this, that's where object-oriented design becomes interesting, because now you have to figure out what should you emphasize, how you should capture it. Any suggestions? Yes.
Well, it's very similar to what my game is, but I had an interface for all the piles.
Okay.
And that has...
Let's see. Let's talk about implementation. Let's talk about implementation. As opposed to interface, which is because what I'm interested in here is presenting the class design as opposed to the behaviors, the expected behaviors, although we can't do class design, of course, without behaviors. So let's when I'm giving this presentation, I'm doing it in terms of the implementation details as opposed to the behavioral design details. So with that proviso.
I guess you'd have to have something to take a card off the pile, put a card on a pile, and check for availability.
Oh, the other thing I should mention here is that all of these, at least in my implementation, all these are immutable. And so you get a pile, and that's it. You can't change it. But that I don't think that matters for what we're going to talk about. So Jansen recommended have top card and what I call drop card and then add card. Actually, I'm embarrassed, but I'll tell you what. I called it plop card because you take a card and you plop it on top. But that embarrassed me, so I changed it to add card. In addition, you also mentioned what was the other one?
Well, it depends on how you implement it, but you have to check the legality.
Right. At some point. And I did that a couple different ways. The first way I did it was add card through an exception if it wasn't legal. But that turned out to be difficult to implement that valid moves available thing. So I instead decided to have a separate check card. Actually, this has a parameter. This has the return type here is card. All right, so these are the behaviors that are uniform among all of these piles. And the thing that varies is this behavior here. All right, so with that observation, how should we come up with some classes for this? And let's just come up with the classes. We'll skip the interface part. We'll work backwards like everybody does. We'll do the classes and then figure out what interfaces they should be.
Actually, I have one quick question.
Sure.
About the foundation, you can't take cards off that?
No, okay. You're right. That's a good point. Foundation are input only, which actually manifests itself down here. Anytime you have a from pile with a foundation, it immediately fails. But yes, you're right. I should have mentioned that. The rest of them you can move cards in and out of, which is actually a good point. We'll come back to that if we have time. All right, classes. Yeah. So I mean, the obvious thing to do is to say, all right, well then I'll have a pile class. This has to be an abstract class. And then underneath that, I will have the Tableau foundation and free piles. This follows directly from what we've been talking about in terms of abstraction. Even though these have different behaviors in terms of the acceptability of the incoming card, we've abstracted those differences into this function, check card, this method, check card, or perhaps, as I did previously, the drop card, which would throw an exception if it wasn't legal. Having done that, the pile class would define those methods, add, top, and drop, and check the signatures of those methods, and then would leave it up to the children to actually do the implementation. Everyone got that? I mean, this is what I've been recommending all along, the way you should approach the design. All right? The problem is that's wrong. And it's wrong for reasons that I haven't talked about in this class. The reason that this, and the reason I'm unhappy with this and didn't actually do it this way, because this representation does not satisfy a property that's known as the Liskov substitution principle. Okay, now, I haven't talked about this, but essentially what the Liskov substitution principle says is, you are allowed to define a child of a parent class if that child behaves in ways that are exact to the parent class. In other words, you can't distinguish between the child and the parent with respect to the parent's point of view. And this was the motivation I gave for the original concept of protocol. Right, I said that, well, you know, we have a class that presents a set of public methods, and that's what the clients see when they look at that class. Any class that satisfies that protocol is acceptable to the clients. That's the idea of this polymorphism. That turns out to be not strong enough. The Liskov substitution principle is a stronger statement. I actually haven't given you the full principle. It's in that book I held up at the beginning of the semester, the program design with Java or whatever the name of it was. It turns out you need to have a stronger constraint, and these classes don't satisfy that constraint. And the question is why? Where does it fail? How can you distinguish the parent class from the children classes? And this is the reason I'm mentioning this. So what the list cost substitution principle says is you are allowed to define a child if you can treat that child undetectably as an instance of the parent. In other words, you are unaware of the fact that you're dealing with a child versus the parent. If you can do that, then you're allowed to define that relationship. If you cannot do it, you can't define that relationship. And it turns out the Liskov substitution principle is a way to solve that fragile base class problem that we were talking about with respect to the set class. But again, I'm not going to go into that. The question here is, how does this definition fail the Liskov substitution principle? That's a good point. We'll come back to that. At this point, let's assume that we're not going to worry about that. But that's a good point. You can detect the difference in the check card. Because different piles, different children, behave differently to the addition of a new card. For example, so a free pile will essentially accept any card as long as the free pile is empty. Which means that if I decide to substitute an instance of free for pile class, how can I detect that?
Throwing something onto that pile.
Twice. Right. If I add two cards in succession to a free pile, it's going to fail on the second one. It could fail on the first one, too, if the free pile wasn't empty. But if we assume the free pile is empty, I throw one card on, that passes. Then I throw the next card on, that fails. Now, that's not the case for either one of these, because they're allowed to accept more than one card. So it is in the behavior of the check card that the Liskov substitution principle fails. What that means is, this is invalid. I can't do this. This is not an acceptable way to structure the system. And this is why I want to talk about this. What can we do then? What's the alternative if I can't do this? This also goes all the way back to my rant on why you should avoid inheritance. I mean, one of the things I kept saying is, oh, no, you shouldn't use inheritance in the way that it normally gets used, in this code-sharing sense, which is essentially what's happening here. Although in this case, we're looking at it from a little bit more abstract point of view than people who do code sharing usually do. So an obvious question then is, well, if I can't do it that way, then how do I do it? I mean, what can I do instead? And that's actually the question to determine. So I can't do this, even though this looks really nice and would be something that would be very convenient to do. It fails the Liskov substitution principle, so we need to come up with something else. What else can we do? And this is the alternative to using inheritance. I said it's perfectly okay to use subtype polymorphism as long as it passes the Liskov substitution principle. But this doesn't. So now what are we going to do? Well, I mean, we've sort of done that, right? Because that's what an abstract class is. So an interface is a stylized abstract class. How does that help me get around this problem? Right, but the behavior, the difference in the substitutions is detectable. See, the whole point behind the Liskov substitution principle is this relationship should result in undetectable differences. But it does. The differences are detectable, and they're detectable in the behavior of this particular. That's one possibility. So one possibility is, all right, if that's the problem, then just let's get rid of the troublesome thing. And in that case, we'd have to get rid of add. Furthermore, we'd have to get rid of check. We'd also have to get rid of drop, because as you pointed out, I can't call drop on foundations, which leaves top. Right? Now I've satisfied the Liskov substitution principle. Because now it's undetectable as to which one of these I'm using here. Which actually brings up a point. You know, inheritance is not, which is something I've been mentioning all along, inheritance is a non-trivial property. To use inheritance correctly is a really complicated thing. So if I remove these troublesome methods and just stay with top, then I can actually do this. And of course that would require that I take care of everything else. Put everything else down there. The alternative to doing that approach The alternative to inheritance in this case is what's known as composition. The idea here is that if this is the problem, well, we'll just get rid of it. And in that case, what that means is we'll have three separate classes. So there are three separate classes. They are just otherwise unrelated. That gets rid of the problem of Liskov substitution because there's no relationship here. There's no parent-child relationship, no sibling relationship. Oh, we don't have an issue here. But what is the problem? Exactly. We have redundant methods here because, again, each one of these is a card pile, which means that I'm going to have to implement card pile in here, I'm going to have to implement card pile in here, I'm going to have to implement card pile in here. Well, that's completely unattractive. Is there an alternative to that? Well, let me put it this way. When I say implement card pile in here, what do I mean? How can I do that in such a way that it would be an attractive option? So you're saying, for example, the tableau pile would have an inner class?
Yeah, I don't think it makes sense.
Okay. Because what would I have to do for found?
Same thing,
right. So now I'm back to the same problem. And the problem here, of course, is replicated code. Each one of these is a pile, so each one of these is going to need to have code that maintains a pile. So the question now is, how do I get rid of that replicated code? And the answer is, since time is flying, I use composition. Composition is the replacement for inheritance based on code acquiring, as opposed to subtype inheritance. In addition to these three classes, I have a fourth class called card pile, which looks a lot like this. It has add, drop, and at least top. Right? In my case, I implemented those three methods. So this has top, drop, and add. What do I do with that? We're almost there, right? So here's my clot of behavior with respect to cards. Exactly. I have an instance variable in each one of these classes called pile. All right, so this has private card pile. I'm reusing the code in this class in each one of these. Now, this still requires me that I implement add card here. I still have to present the add card interface, but that's a really simple thing. All I do now is just, so this is add card, card C. Actually, no, since we're actually defining it. And that's merely a call to pile. And then I'd have to replicate this in all three of these. But this is not this is a reasonably small hunk of code. This is what's known as composition. Notice that this would also solve our fragile base class problem. If you go back and think about the problem with counting set, it was this idea that we were sending operations up to our parent, which was then just whipping right around and sending them back down to the child. If I had used composition, then the counting class would contain as an instance variable a set, and I would just be calling things from the counting class into the set directly as opposed to using inheritance, the inheritance relationship. So the alternative to the kinds of inheritance that I've been railing against, this code inheritance-based structure of systems, is the idea of composition. If you need a clot of functionality, you don't inherit it from your parent. You have a separate class that provides that function, and then you include it as an instance variable. This also moves us closer to the idea of a mix-in. Okay, we talked about mix-ins with respect to interfaces, and I said that they're kind of like interfaces, but they're not really. And one of the differences is a mix-in can contain code. So you could think about using a mix-in card pile that would then be added to Tableau, Foundation, and Free Piles. That turns out to be not quite correct, because mix-ins, generally speaking, depending upon the systems you deal with, mix-ins can't have state. But that's taking us far afield. Well, yeah, it also depends on the systems you're dealing with. So this is the second way that I implemented the assignment, is I had separate classes, which are just completely separate, and then had a fourth mix-in class that I use as an instance variable for each one of these. And in here, the only method that is actually different in all those cases is the check card method, because that's the one that differs in behavior between these three. Okay, any questions about that? Yes?
How faulted are we going to be on the assignment if we use the...
I haven't talked about it, so I don't anticipate. But, I mean, the reason I'm talking about this is because I've said that, you know, I keep saying, don't use inheritance, don't use code sharing inheritance. That's bad. But I haven't told you what to use instead. And this is an example of what you can use instead. You can use composition instead of code-sharing inheritance. And I really haven't given you any definitions of when you should use behavioral subtyping or behavioral inheritance, right? I've just said, well, you know, you have this public interface. You have this protocol, and if you have two classes that match in their protocol, then you have this parent-child relationship. And that's okay, but as I indicate, that's not strong enough, because you can still run into trouble, as we saw with respect to the set and counting set. They had the same protocols, right? Set and counting set had the same protocol. So there's a protocol match there, and wow, I should be able to treat them as parent and child. When we did, we still had that little problem that I showed you. We had double counting there. The reason we had that double counting is they matched in terms of protocols, but they were not Liskov substitutable. That's the object-oriented design part of this class, which, as I said, I'm not going to emphasize that much. But I felt I should talk about what you should use instead of using code-sharing inheritance. And one of the things, the principal thing you use is what's known as composition. Questions about that?
In a sense, isn't that just duplicating code, though?
Exactly. It is. That's the unfortunate thing. That's true. That's true. The hope, though, is, I mean, this is the code you're copying, right? So it's relatively simple. It's straightforward. The problem here is that if you have a lot of methods in your mix-in class, you're going to have a lot of these, right? But the hope is that the replicated code across the individual classes is going to be sufficiently small that that's not a problem. You're absolutely right that, you know, it's replicated code, and the little red flag should go off in your head when you see that. On the other hand, it's reasonably simple. So, another example of related to composition is what's known as wrapping, which we had talked about earlier with respect to numbers. But in this case, we're talking about wrapping one class in another. Any questions? Any other questions? Matt's point was actually a good one about getting rid of drop, but unfortunately we're out of time. So if there are no other questions, yes.
What was the Java doc?
Sorry? Oh, yes.
For the overview,
right?
HTML, is there a special command you should put into the console or anything?
It looks like this. So your java.doc command should look like, let's make this big.
Do we actually submit the java.doc to you?
You submit the code, and the java.doc will be generated. So the java.doc, let's see, Java doc minus quiet.
So once you make everything's okay in it, we can just kind of delete all of that.
Right.
Okay.
What you want to type, which you can't see because I turned off the, let me see if I can turn it on. Not quite, but quiet. Java.quiet overview, player API overview, and then the, what do I got here? Impl. Actually, that's not going to work. This, everybody knows this isn't going to work, right? Why not?
That's what you do at the beginning.
Hmm?
Those are your packages?
Right.
Should they be at the beginning or on the flags?
No, no, that's, it's not going to work because it's looking for package directories and slash is not a character in a package directory, so let's try that. Okay, well, in this case, I shouldn't have put player in. So that worked. So what you have to do is you have to specify where the overview documentation is. It can be anywhere is the point, so you have to actually tell JavaDoc where it is. The package-specific documentation has to be in the package directory, so you don't have to tell it there. You just have to give it the right name. But for the overview documentation, you have to tell it with the minus overview option. And let's see, this is what it looks like. Oh, all classes, I guess? No. How do I get back there? How do I get to it? Overview? No. I don't know how to get... Well, I suppose we could start from the beginning. No. Huh, that's a good question. Well, let's go back to the beginning again. Hello? I don't know why I'm not seeing it. I don't know why I'm not seeing it. But that's what you have to do, just use the minus overview. Any other questions?
So is Player API a package, or is... I thought it was a class, Player API.
No, Player API is a package.
Oh, so you'll be calling any public class within that package.
Right. The idea being that anybody that wants to implement a front end to your game only has to look in the Player API package and use whatever features you provide there.
Okay. And are you, when you are testing the code, are you just like randomly calling classes?
Yes.
So I should be able to rebound from things, like weird things that are happening. Like if you created a deck or something like that, and then you call new game, you should be able to just wipe everything out.
No, you should not be able to do that.
Oh, you shouldn't be able to start a new game.
No, I shouldn't be able to wipe out your... you should be able to handle any possible inputs.
Yeah, okay.
Right. I don't remember exactly... Generally speaking, I have to look at your code before I write the tests, is the way it usually works. But any other questions?
Just a quick one. How do you document the packages? Or is there a way to document, like, if, say, I want to add a little description to the Player API?
Yes. It's called package.html. Is that what it's called?
It tells you. Yeah.
I'm
okay.
Just making sure you can do it because I tried doing it.
Yeah, I did it.
I don't understand why I'm not, because I do have overview documentation here someplace. Where am I? Yeah, so there's the overview. And there's the documentation. I don't know why I didn't see it. But okay. All right, see you next week.